4 o'clock suited them all, the wife, the husband, the lover. 4 o'clock, when time in the city quivers on its axis, the day not yet spent, the wheels of evening just beginning to turn. The handover hour was how Marius liked to think of it. Marius the cynic, Marius who held that natural selection gave the light of God, and humanity the light and natural selection. Marius, who anticipated no more big adventures for himself, not even that last adventure left to modern man, ecstatic, immoderate, unseemly, all-consuming love. Marius, who took pride in being beyond surprise or disappointment, there being nothing to expect of anybody, least of all himself. Marius, the heartbroken. He was 35, though he looked and sounded older, tall and hazardously built, with a face suggesting ecological catastrophe. Lost city of Atlantis eyes, blasted cheeks, a cruel, dried-up riverbed of a mouth. Women found the look attractive, mistaking their precariousness for his. Me too, though I was in every respect his opposite, I was the ecstatic he thought the world had done with. I am the one whom love consumes. We're all fundamentalists now, regardless of whether we're believers or we're atheists. One way or another, you have to be devout. Marius worshipped at the altar of disbelief. I at the altar of Eros. A god's a god. Faith is said to make you strong. My faith was of a different sort. I believed in order to be made weak. Love's flagellant in weakness, I found my singularity. 4 o'clock it was, anyway, the handover hour. A conceit so lewd I can barely breathe, imagining Marius imagining it. As for who was handing over what, that is not a question that can be settled in a sentence, if it can be settled at all. The beauty of an obscene contract is that there's something in it for everyone. The wife, the lover, the husband. I was the husband.
As we've just heard, this is a story told by a man, Felix Quinn, whose governing passion is to see his wife sleep with another man. How did you find a man like this?
You can find anyone in your heart. Anyone. If you have a look. If you've got the courage to look. I don't know if it's courage. If you've got the will to look. They say of Shakespeare, was it Coleridge said of Shakespeare that every man was there, that the greatness of Shakespeare was that he had access to everyone in himself. I think we have access to absolutely everything in ourselves if we have the balls to go looking. What makes you go looking might be your real question, and that's another question, and who knows what makes you go looking for what you go looking for, since we none of us go looking for everything.
Did it? So he found you rather than you thinking this is... You found yourself just starting to write about him, or...?
Well, that makes it sound a little more serendipitous,
right,
than it is. I've gone looking for characters like this before. I can't pretend otherwise. Masochism interests me. Masochists interest me for all sorts of reasons. They're terrific to write about because they're losers, and losers are more fun to write about. In fact, the truth about a masochist is somewhere or other he senses a victory, but he senses victory in loss and in those sorts of paradoxes. There is much fun to be had. A jealous masochist like Felix, because not all masochists express their masochism in this form, is particularly good to write about because extreme and obsessional jealousy when it's gone over the edge, is wonderful. Partly it's funny. People often go to Macbeth, and are surprised to find themselves laughing. Some productions of Othello deliberately play it for laughs. I don't think it's necessary. I think there is laughter of a very uncomfortable sort there in jealousy, because jealousy is so unreasonable and so greedy. And the sight of somebody greedy for suffering, as Othello is and as my character Felix is, fills you with mirth as well as its opposite, because the language is so egregious and so extravagant.
Yes.
And their hunger for it, they like to hear, and jealousy feeds on that. That's why jealousy is so terrific to write about. It's a novel thing. It's wonderful for novels because jealousy is wonderful for words, because jealousy feeds on words. Othello is full of words. My hero, Felix, is full of words and full of books. He reads to find jealousy. He doesn't know whether he goes to books to find jealousy or whether he went to books and found that which made him jealous. But books are the domain of it. Language is the domain of jealousy. You grow the more jealous by every word you use. You hear yourself say it. You hear yourself say what it is that the person you're jealous of has done. And in the word you see, in the word you see the act. Would that the general camp had tasted her sweet body, says Othello, a favourite line of mine, a favourite line of Felix's, an important line in the book. Because at that moment, Othello is pretty much saying, I want to see it. Show it me, Iago. Iago is appalled by this. But that's Othello. No sooner does Othello express his dread, than in the dread he sees a half wish, or in the dread he sees the picture of what he dreads.
Yes, we're not accustomed to think of jealousy as wish fulfilment, but he is very expressly getting a kind of pleasure from this. This is a sort of refinement of jealousy.
Well, you say we're not normally accustomed to seeing jealousy like that.
Or recognising it.
I am. I am, as a reader of literature and as a teacher of literature, that was what I saw, that was what I kept seeing. There's a lot of literature in this novel because of that, because it seems to me what's one of the interesting things, that what you've just said is the case. We are not, some people are not accustomed. I don't know, therefore, what they're reading. I don't know how people read Othello otherwise. They just turn it into a simple morality tale. Othello gets too jealous. You shouldn't be too jealous. If you're too jealous of somebody, it will take up their space, suffocate them, ruin both your lives, the end. Another morality tale. It's much more interesting than that. It's psychologically much more interesting than that. Generally, I would have thought it's just generally a truth about all our passions, that they are contrary. That the thing that we dread in almost every sphere is a thing that we half desire. Why else do we dread it? Why else do we dread it as we do? Why else do so many characters in Shakespeare, play after play after play after play, see jealousy, see infidelity when there's no reason to see? No reason in The Winter's Tale. Nothing's happened. Mm. Absolutely nothing. And the speed with which they leap at it. Shakespeare is the great genius of jealousy. I actually think that's his first subject. And that's the thing that he knows. And that should be apparent to all of us who read him. That we leap at jealousy as from something that we cannot face, as from something that we dread, but that in that dread, we leap towards it in the very act of leaping from it. That's what I'm saying.
Mm. I mean, clearly in this book, Felix's condition is nonetheless pretty extreme, but he is keen to persuade himself and us that he's merely taking love to its farthest possible extreme.
I don't know whether he cares about anybody else. I don't know whether he cares about you or the readers much. I mean, he offers to, but I think...
Is he not trying to persuade himself, at least?
I don't think he has to.
Mm.
I don't know. One never knows what one's done. It might very well be you will be probably be a better reader of what's happened than I am, because with me, you have to deal with, you know, buried intentionalities and all sorts.
Mm.
But it wasn't my idea that Felix would have to persuade himself. It was my idea simply that Felix so felt this to be the truth that he expressed it as a truth. He plays games sometimes. He dares. He dares people to... He says more than is true. For example, he says... The thing that struck a lot of reviewers of this book, no man has ever loved a woman and not imagined her in the arms of somebody else. He said, no man. Well, you know, you can't say anything applies to, you know, to all men. No men, nothing. That's a deliberate, you know, tease. And I'm surprised how many reviewers kind of rose to that. I would have thought pretty obvious bait, but there you are. You can always fish out a reviewer. But that's a willful bit of play with readers. But I don't think he's having to persuade himself. I think he knows that to the bottom of his soul, that this is a truth for him. And he suspects, from what he's observed, from what he knows of himself, from looking into his own heart, and from what he's read, and he's very well read, that it's a more general truth than is generally accepted.
You're persuaded by Felix, are you?
I'm persuaded by Felix's feelings. I am persuaded that, and I didn't need a lot of persuading, that any intense dread contains its opposite. I would have thought this is just a commonplace of psychology, and I haven't studied psychology. But I read a bit when I was writing this book, because I thought, well, I know what the literature says, what the novels and the poems and the plays say. It'd be interesting to have a look at what the psychologists say.
And the clinical literature confirms it, didn't it?
When you can find the right stuff, the best clinical literature bows immediately to the best actual literature, because it knows where the great truths are to be found. But Freud, no.
And as you say, it is Fichte's Passion is very literary indeed. And you're also interested, as an analogy to that, the process of reading is a kind of contains a kind of jealous wishing for the worst characters you might like. You're kind of hungry, he says, and it's quite easy to believe, to see the worst befall them.
What it occurs to Felix to think is that the thing that he does is a jealous husband. His greed to know. Tell me, Marissa, tell me what he did, tell me what he said, tell me where he put his hand, tell me what you did, tell me what you said, tell me, which is the time-honoured catechism of jealousy. Anybody who's been jealous knows that they do that. I think Felix at one moment says it's at that moment of jealousy that the greatest philosopher and the commonest, most educated man are identical. In jealousy they become one. They are as gross and lascivious in their curiosity as one another. Tell me, what then? And even when people don't ask those questions, they think those questions. Some people are wise enough about themselves to know that they couldn't bear the answer. Tell me, the person tells you and you kill them. Is the way it goes for some people.
Yeah.
But others do practice the game of tell me, and can bear the answers. That requires, you know, another person who will tell you. And it occurs to Felix that that's very much like what reading is. You read and you want to know what happened. That gross curiosity to know what happens next is, there is no difference between the curiosity of the lover wanting to know the jealous narrative and the curiosity of the reader wanting to know that narrative. So he goes a little bit further because he's the kind of man who always likes to take a thing to its extreme. But Felix goes further and says, well, maybe in the writing of a novel, sometimes, and he has many instances, and we could talk about those instances all day if we had the time. He has many instances in which the novelist himself, as it were, plays pimp to the heroine. And enjoys, because for Felix those two are interchangeable, the ignominy of seeing the heroine he has invented and who is therefore his and whom he adores, given or giving herself to a man often unworthy. Tessa de D'Urbervilles is on television recently,
a
great example of it. She says it's so lurid and hot. She says at one moment, I am, when she goes back to Alec D'Urberville, I am his creature now. What an extraordinary thing to say. I'm not sure that Tessa de D'Urbervilles herself would say, I am his creature now. I hear Thomas Hardy saying, for Tess, you are his creature now. He likes the sexual violation
and
of
panting
her.
Slightly.
Yes. In novel after novel of Hardy, you feel that Hardy gives away, for the sake of his own authorial suffering, the woman he most cares about, to a man, to the last man she should truly be with, sexually. They are novels about sexual jealousy and written out of sexual jealousy.
This story is told through the eyes of a man who's in many ways trying to turn his erotic fantasy life into three dimensions and who clearly doesn't see the people around him very clearly. I wonder how, as a writer, you managed to, since the story is told through his eyes, how you managed to allow the real characters to peep through.
Well, if I have, and of course I hope I have, and that's always a charge, you know, that one's conscious one might be open to, that you haven't let the characters escape either your grip or Felix's grip. And a novelist, however loose a novelist's grip, and I like to think I have quite a loose grip, and I certainly don't know, you know, I'm not the kind of novelist who plans it all out and knows what's going to happen. I like to think my characters determine what's going to happen, and they do often. But still, there's bound to be an authorial grip. And this is a novel about somebody who has his own authorial grip. So it's hard for those characters to escape. And it's hard to find a way of suggesting them because it's Felix's voice about them all. So the trick, the technique, the skill was, and I don't know how I've done it, I don't know how you do it, I can't describe how you do it, but you just have to find a way of letting them live their lives independently of. So you just suggest ways in which Felix doesn't see all there is to see about them. You suggest ways, and that grows as the novel goes on, in which Felix is subtly being told again and again that what he thinks has happened might very well not have happened. And we also see Felix making surmises that are impossible. He offers to have heard things he couldn't possibly have heard. He offers to know things he couldn't possibly know. So we as readers go, well, he couldn't know that, so they are not entirely what he thinks they are. But there's a moment in which you just change the pitch of even Felix's voice so that somehow or other you were enabled to feel at this moment they are absolutely in his grip and what he sees, and at that moment they are more dispassionately viewed by him and therefore by me and therefore somehow or other by... It's always the case with a first-person novel. You have to find a way in which the world, some world, exists outside that first person. And there are just moments in which she acts, says what she says, and we feel, I hope we feel, that that's not, she's not Felix's woman at that point. I hope, I mean, reviewers have said so, and I hope that's the case, that they feel the power of her apart from him, that they feel that she's not just acting out his needs, that she is her, that she is a woman who finds in this role, in which he casts her, it's true, but nonetheless she finds something in herself that can play it out, that can be it. She is an adventuress. She is an adventuress on her own part. She might not have chosen that particular adventure had she been married to a different man, but nonetheless she's not simply his, she's not his property in the acting out of it.
His creature.
His creature.
Yes.
Oh, that's a thrilling concept.
Just finally, I wondered, you were saying earlier, rather understandably, sadly, that you're aware of writing for a smaller, a diminishing audience for serious fiction. As somebody who's dedicated their life to literature, both teaching it and reading it and writing it, is this a morbid symptom?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. You feel it more between novels. When you're writing your novel, you can't afford to think this. You just can't afford to think this. You have to believe that what you're doing is not only the only thing that matters to you, but the only thing that matters to the world. For I just think I'm writing for the universe. I don't think I'm writing to the 19 readers to which the British reading public has now dwindled. I think there are millions out there, and then you have to face the fact that the world couldn't give a damn, mainly.